This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes or your favorite podcast place, and make sure to rate and review us wherever you're listening to us. Did you ever notice that elite athletes seem to be getting older? In 2016, Peyton Manning won a Super Bowl for the Indianapolis Colts at the ripe old age of 39. A year later, Tom Brady did the same thing at the same age, but for the New England Patriots. Tennis great Serena Williams became the oldest woman at age 36 to be ranked number one in the world. The list goes on and on. My guest today is Jeff Berkovici, formerly of Forbes and currently the San Francisco Bureau Chief for Inc. He's also the author of the new book, Play On, The New Science of Elite Performance at Any Age, which doesn't just discuss how the pros keep getting better and better while they get older and older, but how the rest of us can keep upping our game as we move into middle age and beyond. This is a book about self-improvement and taking control, not just of your life, but of your body and your mind, too. Jeff, thanks for talking.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk first about the dimensions, of kind of the hook here that elite athletes are doing better at older ages. I mean, you know, I mentioned some of the stuff you talk about in your book, Peyton Manning, Serena Williams, the list goes on. Who are some of the other kind of breakthrough athletes who are putting up, you know, big, big numbers or winning big things later than they used to?
Well, you can't not talk about LeBron James. I mean, he's 33, which by basketball standards isn't extremely old. But if you look at the number of minutes he's played in his career, he has the body of someone who, you know, he's put on the mileage of somebody who's over 40 now. Mm-hmm. I mean, the last couple seasons he's played more minutes on the court than anybody else in the NBA, which is just
incredible.
But
he's a loser. Come on. You know,
he's
only in the last three championships, he's only won one, right? So,
yeah, that's true. I mean, but hey, batting, you know, that batting average will get you in the Hall of Fame.
That's true. I know I cannot pronounce his name. I have trouble with your name as well. I have trouble with my own name. But Jaromir Jagr, the hockey player, is one of your key exhibits as well.
Oh yeah, I love Jagr. He was 44 when I wrote the book, and I talked to the coach that they all call him Yags. That Yags gets out of bed in the middle of the night, makes him run up and down the hotel hallways, dragging sleds full of weights with him at 2 a.m. He's a great example. Shalane Flanagan's somebody that I mean, even since I wrote the book, she won the New York Marathon at 36. Mm-hmm. I mean, there really is just Roger Federer, I think, my money, he's the most incredible example of longevity in all of sports, because when you go into tennis and the way that tennis has changed in the last like 30 years, it's become so much more physical, so much more brutal and demanding on the body. And somehow over that time, average age has actually gone up in tennis. Mm. And he is just a level above everybody else when it comes to his movement and how that translates into his longevity.
And this is amazing too, because I'm thinking back and I'm going to forget exactly how old he was, but like I'm 54 and I can remember George Blanda, who at the time was the oldest football. I think he still may be the oldest football player to ever like take the field. And he was a quarterback and a kicker. And I think he ended up playing into his 40s. But, that was at a time in the 60s and 70s when the average football player was probably 5'10 and, 180 pounds or something. So they looked old, too. I mean, like they just weren't in shape. So what is it about, like, what has changed fundamentally that allows sports to become more demanding, more brutal, and yet older people are able not just to keep up, but to actually keep ahead of the pack?
So I think what we've seen is two swings of the pendulum, and you sort of hinted at the first one, which is, you know, starting in, depending on what sport you're talking about, but, you know, kind of the 60s or 70s, we saw this professionalization of a lot of sports where athletes started, you know, training like it was their jobs because it was becoming their you know, year-round jobs.
And that was partly because they were getting paid more, right? I mean, because you read old stories about baseball and football players and stuff, you know, who were selling aluminum siding during the off season, and they just didn't work out, right? They would go to spring training or something for 6 weeks and, you know, and lose the winter fat and kind of get back into shape. But so that's their year-round playing. And is part of that just because they can afford to?
Yes. Yeah. A huge part of it is because they can afford to. The money is so much bigger, you know, TV rights, the way TV rights deals and sponsorships have changed sports.
Free agency. I mean, certainly in you know, baseball, it's amazing how little baseball players made until the early 70s, really.
Yeah, the economics of it are really interesting, and how that provides, you know, athletes, not just changes the way that they train in terms of having an off season, but also the incentives for staying in their sport. And we're seeing, so now we're seeing in a lot of sports what happened in, you know, the major sports like 20, 30 years ago. We're seeing that happen in smaller sports because of whether it's because of, you know, streaming rights or brand sponsorship deals or whatever. We're seeing a lot of athletes now who, in sports where, you know, the convention, like you would retire, you do an Olympics and then you'd retire and go get a real job. We're seeing athletes make that a career. So that is actually one probably under, I mean, I don't really go into it in the book because it's about economics rather than science, but you know, that's part of this longevity boom too.
Yeah. Cause I mean, somebody like you mentioned Federer, he must make, I mean, he, you know, he makes a lot of money playing tennis, but I mean, that has to be totally dwarfed by the number of his endorsements.
Right. And if you look at something at like extreme sports for, you know, a lot of outdoor sports, things like that, I mean, those things are now careers in ways that they just couldn't have ever been in the past. But anyway, so you saw this first, you know, the first swing of the pendulum was the professionalization of sports training and the way it led to, you know, this like bigger, faster, stronger athletes and, you know, year round training, year round competition schedules, all that stuff. So that kind of, you know, that was happening in the 80s, 90s. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, mysteriously, athletes were not lasting, you know, were not really lasting longer. Injury rates were going up in, in pretty much all major sports. So it was what I chronicle in the book is this, the next swing of the pendulum, which is this much greater, you know, more widespread, more sophisticated recognition that it's so often not about bigger, faster, stronger, but about, you know, as they say in the cliche, you know, work smarter, not harder. But what that really means is managing the buildup of fatigue, being able to cultivate the fitness that you need in for whatever your sport is, while optimizing for what you'd call freshness. You know, this much better understanding that an athlete who is highly, highly trained but is not fresh is not performing to the level of their fitness, and they're also at risk for the kind of injuries that that shorten careers.
And so in a weird way, you need to be in better shape all year round, but a lot of the times that takes kind of the form of not pushing yourself 365 days a year.
Yeah, exactly. And it's something that, I mean, it's not a radical new understanding. You know, you can go back. I mean, basically, what we're talking about is this thing called periodization, where, you know, periodization is a program of training that's designed to yield peak performance at a certain point in time, right? So if the most straightforward example of this is if you're training for something like a marathon, you do, you know, more and longer runs as you get closer to the marathon date, and then, you know, you're at your fastest on the marathon date, and then afterwards you rest for a while before you start training another training cycle.
And you don't do a 25-mile run the week before a marathon.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You have a taper period, and you don't try to be, you know, your fastest year round. But the problem is, you know, historically was that in a lot of sports, you know, as they became this year round thing, this idea of having a natural cycle of sort of stress and recovery had disappeared from these sports. You know, if you are a basketball player, you can't say, okay, I'm going to go into the season at, you know, sort of 50% fit, and then we'll work up. You know, we'll get fitter and fitter as we get towards the postseason, because you won't make the postseason. So sports like basketball didn't know how to you know, all they knew was bigger, faster, stronger. They didn't understand how to implement this idea of balancing fitness and freshness. Mm-hmm. And it's the more sophisticated understanding of how to do that, that is a force that I would say is probably the single biggest force that has extended athletes' careers.
So who are some of the kind of theoreticians? And I guess they're scientists. And I don't mean to be putting them down by that. I mean, they're kind of like, are they kinesthesiologists? But who are some of the, you know, I mean, it wasn't in certain cases, it was coaches and athletes who figured this out. But the book is also filled with kind of stories of lunkheaded coaches who were like, you know, you've got to train every day like it's your last day on earth, and they would just burn through people. You know, who are some of the landmark thinkers who kind of created this new understanding of performance?
I talked to a guy named Raymond Verheijen, who is a coach, and yeah, I guess you would say a sports scientist. Mm-hmm. It's the lines do tend to be blurry around, you know, who's a scientist and who's a practitioner in sports. But he is somebody who came out of European soccer. I mean, he would say football. Mm-hmm. He's a Dutch coach and physiologist, and he was, you know, working with teams like the Dutch national team, the Russian national team, South Korean, worked with a couple Premier League clubs in England, and he's the guy who sort of started beating the drum, saying, you know, we are overtraining these players. Mm-hmm. We are especially overtraining our fastest players. They're the ones who need the most recovery, and we are, you know, because of the way we're training them, we're seeing this epidemic of, in soccer, it's really hamstring injuries. You know, every team has felt the pain of, we have this amazing striker, and for some reason he's spending half the season with hamstring injury. He said, well, it's because, you know, we're training them wrong. We're making our strikers train the same way we train our midfielders and our fullbacks, yeah. and it doesn't make any sense. So he was pushing for, you know, I mean, basically it boils down to more rest and a different approach to periodization. Mm-hmm. In the NBA, where you really saw that kind of thinking catch on initially was at the San Antonio Spurs, where, mm-hmm. you know, around 12 or 14 years ago, Greg Popovich started saying, you know, I'm going to rest my healthy players. I think, you know, I have these players, a lot of them are older, and I think that they need more rest than they're getting. So I'm just going to start giving them breaks during the season.
Right. Which was always seen as, I mean, like a cop out. And I, you know, one of the things that I find really interesting about the book, and again, part of it's my age, and when I was particularly interested in sports, you know, that was like the idea that, you know, somebody like Cal Ripken Jr. say would, you know, during when he was playing consecutive games for the Baltimore Orioles, everybody kind of knew it was impairing his performance, but nobody was willing to say, and certainly not around him, you know, would you just sit a game out, you fucking idiot? Like you're, you know, it's great that you'll be the new Iron Man, but at what cost to both yourself, your stats, and your teams, you know? But it's, I mean, so I find it really interesting. And obviously Popovich and the Spurs, I mean, between at a point when Tim Duncan and David Robinson were there, he had what, like about 100 years worth of playing talent and really maximized them. And they had great long careers.
Great. They had great long careers. They were the healthiest team in the league for, you know, almost every year for like, I mean, the stats only go back so far, but basically for, you know, a run of many years, they were either the healthiest or the second healthiest team in the league in terms of the number of player games lost. And they contended for championships almost every season during that time too. So that's the kind of thing that every other coach in the league looks at and says, I mean, so when he started doing this, it was controversial. He's getting blasted by ESPN mm-hmm. commentators. Yeah. He's getting fined by the league commissioner, says you're ripping the fans off. But it was so clearly the smart way to do it mm-hmm. that within a couple years, just, you know, all the other coaches basically said, you know, we got to copy this.
Yeah, some of that reminded me of the old running coach at University of Oregon, Bill Bowerman, who was famous for, and I guess he started doing this in the 60s, and he referred to it as LSD. I mean, you know, he's the guy who trained Steve Prefontaine, who in many ways refused to listen to Bowerman and had a short career, not simply because, you know, he died young, but Bowerman would force his team to do long, slow distance, or LSD. And that the cross country people and the distance runners couldn't stand it. Like, they wanted to train all the time, and he would basically fine them if they ran every day. So it's, I mean, it's kind of interesting to see that vision kind of get updated and quantified and kind of scientized, I guess, for lack of a better term. Because talk about how these guys, you know, part of when I was reading your book, it reminded me in certain aspects, in certain ways of Moneyball, where you have this conventional wisdom that it really dominates an industry, you know, and then like a new understanding comes along and you have to fight back that old conventional wisdom, which is no, you know, you train hard every day, you give it 110%, you leave everything on the field every day, every practice, et cetera. You know, how, like how, what ended up being convincing? Is it the championships? Or is it the data? Is it testimonials?
I think that's a really great example, the Moneyball comparison, because it is, I mean, what you see. So the thing that that Raymond Verheijen said to me, you know, and wrote, he's got a book too, mm-hmm. is that it's really hard for coaches to accept to change their ways. I mean, coaches mm-hmm. tend to be former players, and they very strongly feel, you know, this is the way, you know, this is the way I was taught to do things. Mm-hmm. They don't necessarily tend to be people who, you know, are reading a lot of scientific papers. And so even in the face of mounting evidence, often they will continue to do things in you know, in a way that harms their interests. Mm-hmm. I think that one reason we saw it adopted in basketball, you know, I mean, in basketball versus in other leagues, I mean, for instance, you would think that for the NFL, for instance, should have the greatest incentive to be open to new ideas and new science, right? Because, you know, the money is so big there. But I think basketball has a little more openness because of the way that the players have more leverage, mm-hmm. you know, because there are fewer of them. There's an international market for talent. So I think that you know, if they think something in the NFL, there's so many players on the roster that they can right. afford to kind of treat them as cannon fodder.
Yeah.
You know, teams don't care a huge amount about the fact that the average running back's lifespan, you know, is about one contract. Whereas mm-hmm. in the NBA, you know, if a bunch of players are looking at and other teams are looking at what's happening at San Antonio and saying, geez, these guys are having, yeah. you know, they're really healthy and they feel good at, you know, at 35 or 38, like they're going to make their displeasure known. You know, they might have some leverage there.
Yeah, and it seems to be much more of a players' league than a coaches' league, for sure. And I mean, you know, it's that obviously in college, it's all about the coach, and in the NBA, it's all about the one or two stars on any given team. Talk a little bit about this periodization idea of, you know, and of working smarter, not necessarily harder.
So there's a great guy that I talked to. He's a Canadian sports scientist and coach. His name is Trent Stellingworth, and he works with a lot of their Olympic.
By the way, that athletes. Is about the most Canadian name I think I could come up with. I'm suspicious already, but yes,
he's about the most Canadian person you could come yeah. up with, because he, among other things, he is just unreasonably nice. And the athletes he coaches includes his wife, who is an Olympic middle distance runner. And a really fascinating person with a great story in her own right. So he turned me on to this idea of polarization training, which comes out of the world of endurance sports. It's a concept that has been gaining adherence, you know, over the last 10, 15 years. And the way that Trent put it is the most common mistake that athletes make is they go too hard on their easy days and too easy on their hard days. Mm-hmm. The key, the sort of organizing concept that I really talk about a lot of the book is fatigue and the buildup of fatigue. So, a good training program is one that really manages this accumulation of fatigue, so that it doesn't rise to the level where it's interfering with performance or causing you to have injuries. You know, that's mm-hmm. that's basically what a periodization program is.
Right.
So this polarization idea is that you sort of don't want to mix your chocolate and your peanut butter. You mm-hmm. you want to, when you are you're getting different benefits from high intensity training than you are from high volume training. Those LSDs that you were just talking about,
right.
You know, that's high volume training that is increasing your cellular energy output in in one, you know, through one pathway, and then through another pathway, you're increasing your output through high intensity training. But what you don't want to do is go a little too hard in your volume training in a way that leaves you with fatigue that then lowers your ceiling when you want to go out and do really intense training. You want to keep those things separate.
What, in terms, what is the role of drugs in any of this, by the way? Because, I want to come back to the question of the intensity and stuff, but there's also, you know, there's been a huge kind of revolution in performance enhancing drugs along with performance enhancing training programs. And as you were talking about before, about taking this stuff seriously, like where, you know, I'm a professional athlete, I'm going to professionalize myself and all the people around me. How does that work? Because there's certain people who are not necessarily, you know, and this isn't a moral issue, particularly for a libertarian magazine or a libertarian outlet, but a lot of people will say that steroids in baseball, for instance, and Jose Canseco has written openly about using steroids and all of that, is usually trotted out as a prime example of somebody obviously used steroids and other kind of muscle builders and then became not muscle bound. I mean, that's a nonsensical old term, but he became one-dimensional. He became stiff. He, you know, he shortened his career by pumping himself up. That's a, you know, kind of a common understanding. Is that always the case, or are there drugs that are also allowing athletes, and whether they're legal or not within, you know, a particular league, you know, are there, is there a drug dimension to this as well?
Oh, 100%. I mean, steroids and doping, you know, other types of doping, what they're really doing is there's a reason that all of these shady clinics that always seem to be at the center of some some doping scandal. They're always called anti-aging clinics, right? And there's a reason for that. I mean, what they're doing is reproducing the, you know, the cellular environment, the biomarkers of a younger body. You know, often the hormone profile of a younger body. We you know, one of the big changes that happens in an athlete's body as you get older is this thing called anabolic resistance. You know, anabolic as in anabolic steroids. It makes it harder for your muscles to convert protein into new muscle tissue. So, you know, it's really, really hard to untangle the steroid question from the rest of this. And the way that I think about it is sort of, you know, even the athletes who are doping are doing a lot of other stuff.
Right.
And they're doing other stuff because they think that that other stuff works too and is and is worth their time.
Well, and it's clear that, you know, I'm not simply a bunch of blood doping sessions away from becoming, you know, from being the second coming of Lance Armstrong or anything like that. I mean, you know, it's even doping is part of a wider array of things that you're doing, which includes nutrition too, right? I mean, because these guys all seem to be taking food, you know, much more seriously. You know, aren't there stories of people like Tom Brady who will have exactly, what is it, like 3 or 4 almonds a day? You know, but any more than that and, you know, he's done. But
I think you may be confusing Tom Brady and Barack Obama. Wasn't he the 7 almonds?
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, and there was also, I think it's something like The Rock, you know, who was a Canadian football player and a professional wrestler, also claims he hasn't had a piece of candy in like 20 years or something. But this larger focus, I mean, it's on a continuum of, you know, there might be steroids or human growth hormone on you know, one end, but then it's also coming down to eating different types of foods and using different types of nutritional supplements as well to kind of create what you were talking about as a cellular environment.
Yeah, I actually put the my section on doping in the book is in the same chapter as the section on nutrition for exactly that reason. It can be hard, and it also can be hard to draw a hard line between you know, between doping and some of the newer cellular therapies, you know, some of the newer biological therapies that are happening that use, you know, I mean, think about it. One form of doping is blood doping, like, you know, like Lance Armstrong was doing, where you're basically just supplementing with your own blood. And how is that, you know, very different from something like PRP, you know, platelet-rich plasma therapy, right, which is another therapy that, that uses your, yeah, your own blood parts.
Oh, and what we accept as, you know, a performance enhancing drug, too, because it's, is marijuana, which might relax somebody, a performance enhancing drug, even if it's not, you know, going to build body mass or something like that. Yeah. I mean, it all of those questions get really interesting. I mean, they're slightly askew from your main point about, you know, how do you increase performance, or, you know, how do you keep improving performance at older and older ages? But it's really interesting, and it's clear that, you know, leagues are responding to all sorts of scandals. Because, I mean, the Tour de France, at least in the United States, has almost been, you know, completely ruined as a commercial entity because of a series of, you know, of drug scandals, even though what the first drug scandal in the Tour de France, I think, goes back to the second or third year that it was run.
Oh, yeah. And it caffeine. Was probably that, yeah, they were drinking. Oh, caffeine. Oh, yeah. Yeah,
caffeine or absinthe or a mix of both or whatever. Yeah. So it's well, you know, to bring it down to the kind of everyman level, you know, what's in it for me, or and what's in it for you? And I want to talk about your personal experiences, which are both incredibly well rendered and deeply humbling and kind of terrifying for an armchair athlete reader like myself. But so, you know, okay, so, you know, Tom Brady, you know, he's already got a life that, you know, a lot of men want to lead. You know, Serena Williams is, you know, is a god, a goddess, I mean, from Mount Olympus and things like that. But what about the rest of us? How does this matter to us?
I think everybody wants to feel like they're not getting older physically. You know, I don't think anybody wants to feel like their age is a limitation on anything they want to do. And it's certainly statistically, if you look at different generations' attitudes towards the role of fitness in their lives, the role of sports in their lives, you know, we are progressively a more active society. I mean, jogging wasn't really something that was a mass activity, yeah, before the 1960s, you know, yoga, aerobics, right. With every generation, our pursuits become more and more physical. And, you know, to a later point in life, we're expecting to be able to be physical beings. And I think that this phenomenon has a ton of applicability. Yeah. You know, I got into it because I wanted to be able to play soccer, like just play soccer. I knew that I would never be very good at it. But the fact is, it's a pretty demanding thing to do to your body when you're, you know, 35, 40. And unless you take a smart approach to it, you could take a really, really stupid approach to it, which I did, and make your career very short.
There's two things. The soccer game where you were, I guess it was, you were going through a rough patch personally, and you were like, okay, I got to get back into shape and all of that. And then you were sucking wind immediately. So you realize, okay, yeah, you know, when you're 30 or whatever, it's not the same as when you're 20, and God forbid when you get to be 45 or 50. There's that. And then talk about the training place you went to. I think it's called Exos, if I'm remembering it correctly, where you went through one of these like in super intensive training situations that a lot of pro athletes do.
Yeah, I went to Exos. They have a chain of clinics where a lot of athletes train for, you know, they train during their off season, or they train for combines, things like that. There were a bunch of athletes, a bunch of NFL players. They were doing one of their NFL camps. So like LeSean McCoy was there, Colin, yeah, Kaepernick, back when he was, you know, still a football player.
Well, yeah, before he was just planking and destroying all that is sacred in America.
Yeah, before that.
Back when he was a Christian and everybody loved him because he was a black man raised by white adoptive parents who was very Christian. I think he even has like Bible verses tattooed on his body. Yeah, this is a strange and different world, even though it's really only a few years ago. But I'm sorry. Please continue about your. I mean, just reading it, I was like sweating bullets, and just I felt my heart, you know, popping through my throat there.
Well, I did a very mild, so I watched these NFL players do one of their workouts, and then they put me through a very mild version, by necessity, of what they do for a lot of their pro athletes. The guy, my training partner was, a recent college graduate who was, you know, he was one of these people who, He wasn't drafted, but a bunch of teams had said sort of, you know, stay in shape. Maybe you'll get a phone call, that kind of thing. So I did this workout, which is sort of a general strength and mobility workout, mm-hmm. but then it ended on this machine called the VersaClimber, which, you know, you'll find it at some high end gyms. It's sort of,
in some CIA black sites, I think, right? This is pretty much how they got out of it, you know?
Yeah. My favorite. Yeah. So I did this after spending 4 minutes on this machine. I was like, what the hell was that? And I looked it up, and then I found out that, the Cavs used it during in their last championship season, that when the Cavaliers, strength coach was like, I need to get these guys just a little more fit before the finals, mm-hmm. he made them all work out on it. And one of the players, said, we all bonded over, you know, we became closer as a team because of how much we hated the VersaClimber. So I had to, they had me do like 4 minutes on it. It was nothing. I was like, of course, yeah. this will, you know, I can handle 4 minutes of any kind of physical activity. And by the time I got off it, I apparently looked so close to death that the trainer was like, hey man, the Phoenix Coyotes are sitting over there and they're looking over here. Like they're really concerned that you might die. So just like give a little wave or something. Great. I'm so happy that I could humiliate myself in front of an entire NHL team.
Now, part of it is, but at various points you talk about how the kind of rise of the, you know, 7 minute workouts that have been popularized in the New York Times and things like that. You know, that there's the industrial strength version of this, or, you know, the prescription strength, and then there's the kind of over the counter stuff. How do you adapt what you've learned into a kind of sustainable, regular athletic routine, particularly for somebody, you know, who's a journalist for a living? I don't know why I would be interested in learning that particularly, but, you know, how does this play out for you now these days?
So this is the kind of book that I tried not to write a book that would be, you know, a list of do this, don't yeah. this. Don't do this, because that's not really my, my mode as a journalist. And, you know, I don't know that I have the authority to say, do this or don't do this, mm-hmm. but so what I tried to do is, offer some concepts or some frameworks, and the way that I, the way that those concepts and frameworks have changed my life is through things like, you know, this idea of separating intensity from volume that I talked about. That's something where, you know, I definitely structure my workouts. I think now, you know, is today going to be a high intensity day, or is today going to be a high volume day? And it turns out that like high intensity exercise is great, because not only does it have unique benefits that you don't get from, you know, you get certain benefits at going at like 90% of your max that you don't get at 70% of your max, but you also, it's also over really fast. So we should all be very happy about the high intensity workout craze. Right. Another big concept for me that has changed things is thinking in terms of mobility and stability rather than in terms of something like strength. Mm-hmm. You know, that's totally changed. I think that buzzwords that you hear a lot, you know, you hear mobility and stability, you hear quality rather than quantity, you know. So I think now about, you know, not about like how much weight I can lift or how fast I can run, but basically, you know, is my body strong enough to be stable in the ways it needs to be stable, while also mobile, you know, flexible enough mm-hmm. to be mobile in the ways it needs to be mobile. I don't know if that's,
yeah, I find that, you know, really fascinating and very clear. And it may be because of a past life when I was in shape and I used to read a lot about this stuff, but it makes total sense to me. Let me ask you this though. Or a couple of related questions that you touch on in the book. But you know, does this bleed over into your work? I mean, do you find yourself now thinking in terms of kind of high intensity work and, you know, the more kind of low intensity volume, you know, where maybe it's tasks that don't require as much attention, but, you know, have to be done? I mean, do you see this slopping over at all into other aspects of your life?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, absolutely. In fact, While I was writing the book, I even experimented a little bit with something like, do you know Pomodoro, the Pomodoro time yes. management method?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I'm 100% a believer in, you know, the sort of sprint recover rhythms. There mm-hmm. may be people who by nature are marathoners in the way that they work, but I am absolutely, you know, I'm a sprint recover type athlete, to the extent that I'm an athlete, and I'm a sprint recover type worker. And that, you know, I mean, that's one of the things that I love about being a journalist is there are built-in rhythms to our work that allow for those periods of rest and regeneration.
Let me put the book into a larger context of, you know, athletics is interesting. And as you were saying, you know, the physical fitness boom didn't really kick in until, you know, first off, I mean, it was partly it's a luxury good in a lot of ways. But, you know, Americans didn't really start getting fat until after World War II. So, you know, you didn't need to exercise. But at the same time as athletics and fitness, physical fitness started to become more and more a part of our lives, there's also a mental fitness, and there's also a kind of quest for perfection, or it seems like we're, you know, as a society, we're getting richer and richer, and we want more symbolic activity. We're kind of creeping up Maslow's hierarchy. How does what you're talking about here fit into that? And also, you know, that kind of topic that you alluded to of extending our lives by either retarding aging or holding it at bay or just overcoming it.
Boy, that's a yep. big question.
Well, you know, you're in San Francisco, which is, you know, one of the Bay Area is one of the great birthplace of the human potential movement and whatnot. And so, you know, like how do you see, you know, is there a commonality to all of this?
Yeah, I think that there absolutely is. This quest to perfect ourselves. I mean, you know, the wellness movement, the, mm-hmm. I mean, Barbara Ehrenreich just wrote a great book about the sort of idea of you know, wellness as our new national obsession. Mm-hmm. You know, we almost have too much time on our hands. I hadn't thought about the rise of fitness as a goal for the culture as being connected to the sort of, you know, decline of physical labor until you raised that. That's really interesting. I do look in the book, you know, as a reporter, as a tech reporter out here, I'm very aware of basically this phenomenon of people who really think that we, you know, can extend human life until we reach escape velocity.
Yeah. Like, why don't you know, death is it's a bug, not a feature, right? For God's sake.
Yeah, I went to one of these conferences where all the longevity researchers mm-hmm. and other longevity enthusiasts get together and swap new research. Most of it depressing, of course, for them at least. If you think that you might live forever, I don't see. It's funny because I don't see it as I have a very particular take on this, which mm-hmm. is that I do not see. The thing that I'm interested in and the thing that they're interested in as two pieces of the same mm-hmm. phenomenon. I think that, you know, this term health span, that's gaining currency now, as distinct from lifespan, the span of healthy years that you get during your life. I'm all about extending health span. I think that's a wonderful goal. I think that the people who, you know, their focus is on extending lifespan and or immortality, to me, there's something kind of dysfunctional about that.
Well, let me ask you about that and push on it because, you know, and I know and I should tell the audience that one of the reasons I've been following your work is because it's got to be almost 20 years ago. You took an interest in mine for an old magazine that was called Media Life. And you wrote about Reason years ago. But what's wrong with that? Is lifespan or longevity really at odds with health span or just having a better life? Or, you know, what is it that, and I say that partly because libertarians, you know, the extropian movement and the transhumanist movement, which have many eccentrics and excessive claims to, you know, reality and whatnot. What is it about that bugs you?
You know, it's such a good question. And I'm honestly have been trying to get to the bottom of that for myself.
And while you're approaching middle age, this is a good time to do it. So,
I feel like, first of all, I guess there's a certain amount of whataboutism in my skepticism toward it, where I feel like, well, why are we trying to do this when we haven't solved, you know, all of these problems, and yet we're trying to help billionaires live until the 24th century. I try to set that aside, but I do feel like there are, I guess part of it is that often the people that I see associated with this movement and talking about it are people that to me haven't, don't strike me as spiritually or ethically particularly aware. I feel like a lot of our ethics and, our ethics, our sense of compassion, so much of what we are as a society comes from our relationship with death and our own mortality. And I guess I'm worried about if we take that away without knowing how to replace that in our, you replace that role in our society, like, we're tampering with something big.
Oh yeah, no. And there, you know, we've learned this even, when you think about, over the course of the 20th century, lifespans essentially doubled, and we weren't really prepared for that in a lot of ways. I mean, I think everybody who lived to 70 or who had parents who lived to 70, you know, were happy for it, but it's true. We are built, we have certain constraints, and when our, basic facts of life change, we need new ones. And it's certainly worth having that kind of conversation, because lifespans are getting longer and health spans are getting longer and more intense. So I think that's great to kind of put it in those terms. It reminds me of conversations of an old colleague of mine at Reason who's retired, and another one who's still with us. And is one was very much on the let's cure death. And the other one, who was kind of an old world pessimistic soul, was like, I'm already depressed. Now you're really making me want to commit suicide. The idea of being alive forever is like the worst possible thing. Whereas other people are like, no, that's the whole point. But I will just say Play On is a fantastic read. And I want to congratulate you, Jeff, not only on taking up a topic that I think is really fascinating and is in the kind of sweet spot of a lot of things that are going on now, but it's also just masterfully reported and written. So it's a real treat to read. What else are you working on that people would want to know about?
Oh my gosh. First of all, I have to say thank you very much. Yeah. I am working on, I write about, I'm really interested in technologies that, that are driven by scientific innovations. You know, out here in Silicon Valley, we have a lot of value that's been created by companies that are very good at kind of behavioral engineering, very good at grabbing people's attention and getting them to interact with screens in certain ways. And obviously, there are very good reasons to pay attention to that. Mm-hmm. But when I get really excited about a company, it's because it's a company that's doing something that couldn't be done before for actual scientific or technical reasons, and it's something with big implications. So, for instance, I wrote a cover story last year on a company called Memphis Meats that is working to grow actual edible animal meat in labs, in bioreactors, so that this we can replace
we're very interested in that too. And when I say we, I mean myself, but also a number of us at Reason, because this is this is beyond science fiction. It's kind of fascinating, and it touches so many different problems, right? Or concerns. And I'm a vegan, and I have vegan friends, and this is the equivalent of like the late night dorm discussion of like, well, will you eat fat ground meat? Why not? If there's no reason not to.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't know you were a vegan. That's very cool. Talking to that founder actually changed have become what they call a reducitarian now. So I'm eating very little meat, which I wasn't before.
This is I find this an interest. I think we may be going off the rails here, but the idea of a spectrum, rather than saying you're going to either eat only meat or no meat, the idea of reducing things or putting things on a continuum and a spectrum seems to me one of the hallmarks of the 21st century that, you know, we're not talking about binaries anymore, but we're talking more about spectrum or band, you know, kind of bandwidth and direction. And it seems to me really interesting. And I should also point out that I'm a vegan only because it makes it easier for me not to become a total fat shit. I have yet to evolve ethically in the same direction as, I guess, my gut biome. But we've been talking with Jeff Berkovici. He's the author of the excellent new book, Play On, The New Science of Elite Performance at Any Age. Jeff, thanks for talking.
Thank you. It's been really fun.
This has been The Reason Podcast, and I am still Nick Gillespie, your host. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to us at iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts and rate and review us while you're there.